From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we're lucky to have Candy Wolf and Phil Schalero. And we're going to focus today on the Senate confirmation process. As you know, we've done deep dives on every modern presidential transition since Carter, and then also deep dives on issues like personnel and vetting. And today we're going to focus on the confirmation process, which is an essential and important process for a new president to get his people in place. Candy and Phil are two of the most experienced, highly respected legislative experts in the country. They each led the Office of Legislative Affairs in the White House, Candy under President George W. Bush and Phil under President Obama. Candy served as Deputy Senate Liaison during the Bush-Cheney transition. She was then Vice President Cheney's top legislative affairs officer, and then President Bush's. And prior to that, she was one of the top Republican staff members in the Senate. She's now global head of government affairs at Citi. Phil worked for 25 years for Congressman Henry Waxman, did a brief stint in the Senate, and during his times in the House, he had a huge impact. He changed both laws and public opinion on clean air and tobacco, among other issues. He led the legislative affairs effort for the Obama campaign, then the Obama transition, and then the White House. And Phil, he's a longtime good friend. He's one of the people I admire the most in the world. He has one major weakness. He has a hard time getting away. So the White House Office of Legislative Affairs, it's a brutal, brutal job. He did that for a while and then left. Obama called him back to serve as counsel to the president. Then he left again, but Obama called him back once more to help save the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. He's truly extraordinary, but don't take it from me. Here's how President Obama described Phil in his recent book.
To lead our legislative affairs office, we had recruited a savvy former senior House Democratic staffer named Phil Schalero. He was tall and balding, with a high-pitched laugh that masked a quiet intensity. And from Congress's first day in session, Phil set out in search of negotiating partners.
So thanks for both being here. And we're going to release this on the Monday after the Senate is sworn in and the day before the Georgia primary, which will determine who controls the Senate. So let's start by your careers. So Candy, why don't we start with you? What drew you to public service and what was your first job in the government?
Well, I always had an interest in public policy, and I started with an internship my junior year of college for then Senator Lowell Eicher from Connecticut, which is where I'm from originally. And that really solidified my interest in Capitol Hill and in politics. And in college, I did a thesis that was a combination of politics and math. I was a political science and mathematics major and decided to study the 1986 tax law change that eliminated the non-itemized charitable deduction for those who didn't file itemized taxes. But it really drew me to public policy. So I moved to DC and went to law school down here and never left, and then worked in various positions. My first job really in the space was at Akin Gump when I started after law school and was working in the tax area around tax public policy, then went to Capitol Hill and worked for Senator Malcolm Wallop, who had moved from his Armed Services Committee to the Finance Committee and needed a tax staffer. And it was 1993, and not many Republicans were going to Capitol Hill then. So I decided that I would give it a shot. And the rest is history. I never really left.
The rest is history. Malcolm Wallop was from Wyoming, of course. My dad grew up in Wyoming. He was one of the only Jewish people in Wyoming, I think. So Phil, how about you? What drew you to public policy and what was your first job in Washington?
I got very involved in an environmental health issue when I was a senior in high school and spent most of my senior year, my first year of college, working on that. And through that process, came to believe that the most direct way to have an impact was in public service. So that became my focus. Like Candy, I was an intern on the Hill with a congressman from South Carolina. And I did that for 4 months. And then there's a similarity in Candy's background of mine. I graduated law school and came to Washington in 1981, which is the mirror image of 1993. There weren't many Democrats coming to Washington then because it was a bad election. And Democrats had lost the Senate and the White House and about 30 seats in the House. So I looked for a job on Capitol Hill and was able to find a junior position to get started.
And was that with Henry Waxman, your first job, or was that with someone else?
My first job was with Congressman Tim Wirth.
Oh, okay.
Who later became a senator. And it was a great experience because the work I had to do in the office, I could basically do in 4 or 5 hours. And if I got an early start in the morning, I could be done by 11 or 12 and then focus on other things that could help the office. And it was just a tremendous experience.
One question very quickly on the Office of Legislative Affairs at the White House. So Candy, what does that office do?
Well, there's a great book that's entitled The White House Staff. I don't know if you've seen it, called Inside the West Wing and Beyond. It's by an author, Bradley Patterson. And there's a section on legislative affairs. And he quotes the renowned Bryce Harlow, who was really the first head of legislative affairs during the Eisenhower administration. And Harlow called legislative affairs team the ambulatory bridge across the constitutional divide. But translated into perhaps English, what is it? It's a team that travels literally between the White House and the Congress, trying to shape legislation, to push through nominations, and to really promote the president's legislative agenda.
And it sounds, I just read Obama's book, which is fantastic, and Phil is in the book throughout, but it also sounds, Phil, like you basically just take a beating every day from people on the Hill who call you up and complain about you or the president and tell you or the president what a terrible job they're doing and what they should be doing differently. So it seems like you kind of take a lot of incoming from Congress as well. And part of your job is to listen and to deflect tension.
I think that's right. My conclusion after doing the job for a while was to do the job right. The person has to be saying no to Congress a lot for what they want and do that during the day. And then in the late afternoon, come back to the White House and then tell other White House staff no on what they want Congress to do, which is why
I wholeheartedly concur with that. You can yell that on both sides.
So if one is doing the job right, there's a term limit on it, because after a couple of years, people on both sides are tired of you saying no, because they both have expectations for what Congress wants the White House to do, White House staff, what the Congress wants to do. And I think Candy said it right. Part of it is translating. Part of it is really identifying the priorities of people on the Hill, things that really are important versus what people want, and the same thing in the White House. And what's fascinating to me, having worked on the Hill for so long, is Congress is a co-equal branch of government. I don't think there's another office in the White House that is as involved as legislative affairs, because virtually everything the president does touches on Congress. And the other compartments in the White House are more siloed, except communications. But legislative affairs isn't, because everything the president is touching, there's a role for legislative affairs.
Well, let's talk about one big aspect of legislative affairs, which is during the transition, the confirmation process. So both of you were key officials during the Bush and Obama transition. And one of the most important aspects of a transition is to get the president's people in their seats quickly, which is critical for national security, for our health security, for our economic interests. And, you know, I think our listeners remember that there are about 1,200 Senate confirmed positions, 1,250 or so, and they need to be confirmed by the Senate, and the Senate moves very slowly. So, Phil, you actually have the record of getting the most people confirmed the most quickly. By the 100-day mark, there were 69 Senate-confirmed officials in the Obama administration, which seems like a very anemic number, but it's the best ever. So why does it take so long, and what are the steps to get someone through the Senate, Phil?
We obviously had a Democratic Senate, but even with that, it's enormously complicated. Each nominee goes through a vetting process ahead of time, but then there's a second vetting process after the person's nominated. So working through the committee hearings, working with members of leadership, as Candy will remember, one of the big issues becomes prioritizing the nominees after the cabinet. People on the Hill may have different views than people in the White House on what that sequence is going to be. We started the process early. In October of 2008, I started meeting with Senate leadership and Senate committee chairs and their staff, identifying close to 50 priority nominations for us. The obvious ones are cabinet and sub-cabinet, and there were others. And trying then to start sequencing how we could move through the committee process, the hearing process, and votes on the floor. One thing to keep in mind is there'll be committees that have to do hearings for multiple nominees, like the Finance Committee or the Help Committee in the Senate, where they might have five or six priority nominees that have to get done. So you're stretching the committees to capacity. And then there's the problem of floor time. We were trying to move a legislative agenda. There's a finite amount of time on the Senate floor. So the confirmation process has to be balanced with that. There's a prioritization where the White House will have priorities. The Senate leadership will have different priorities. There may be closer votes for some nominees that have to be factored in. That all takes time. And then the last piece that comes to mind that we could talk about now or later is when nominees become a pawn in a policy dispute. So senators would put holds on nominees. When Candy was doing this, when I was doing this, each nominee needed 60 votes in the Senate, and that's changed. So maybe part of the dynamic will change now. But some of the holds that came were from Democrats and Republicans. So when you add all that together, it ends up being a very complicated, lengthy process. And that's even for the nominees that don't have serious issues.
So it's basically a giant traffic jam getting through the Senate committees and then on the Senate floor. How did you deal with prioritization of legislation versus nominees when Bush came to office, Candy?
Well, most of the time, I would say the legislation ended up with the priority over nominations, unless it was clearly a high-level cabinet or sub-cabinet. So in the first part of my tenure, when I was working with Cheney, we were worried about getting cabinet, sub-cabinet through. By the time I was running Ledge Affairs, it was a second term. And so we had some high-profile cabinet officials, not the least of which was the Department of Defense. And focusing on those nominees was clearly a priority of the president's. Most of the time, and as Phil mentioned, you know, trying to lift holds to work the process by which you can convince the Senate to agree to unanimous consent, because so rarely did you have a floor vote for anyone. It was all about packaging the nominees in a way that would allow for, you know, a unanimous consent vote to get agreement on, you know, 10, 12, 15. The closer you got to the end of a session or recess, the easier it was to try to package nominees and get agreement to move, you know, big groupings. So we tended to focus most of our attention on the nominee process when we were at the stage where it was just before the August recess or before July 4th recess, or clearly as you're getting to the end of a session and you try to move and push as many as you possibly can, working off the holds and get the agreement and try to get everybody through. But I would say as a priority, the legislation still generally took precedence over the nominations.
And obviously during Bush-Cheney, you had a shortened transition, 35 days because of the recount. And the Bush team had a very, very good personnel operation, but basically you had about half as many people at the 100-day mark as Obama did because of the shortened transition. So what was your strategy to get people through quickly coming out of the gate when Bush took office?
Yeah, it was incredibly chaotic. And we didn't have office space for a while. And we were somewhere in McLean.
Right.
And then moved to GSA. And so the focus, we actually used Sherpas. And, you know, the Biden folks are using a different term, but we had people that came in from outside of the process, former White House Ledge Affairs, former, you know, senior leaders in the Senate, people that knew how to navigate the process, and they were tasked with really trying to push through the nominees because we didn't have the bandwidth or the personnel to try to just use a small little transition team to get people through. So we really needed outside help. And in the end, we were more the managers, try to make sure that the process was running smoothly, the issues were presented, and that we could come up with a more concerted strategy to try to get people through if they were getting stuck. But we really had to rely on outside help. And, you know, at the time, David, the same thing is what the Biden administration is going to face here. It was a 50-50 Senate then. And we had pre-inaugural hearings that were happening in a Senate that was Democrat controlled at the time. And then after inauguration, it flipped to Republican control. And then if you recall, 6 months in, Jim Jeffords from Vermont flipped from Republican to independent and caucus with the Democrats. And so it flipped control again. And so it was really having to work with the committees and to get a lot of the committee chairs as they kept flipping
right,
to try to get the nominations through because you'd have different staff that were leading it at different times. So I must say, you know, it was slow, but really initially required outside help because we just didn't have the personnel to push them all through.
Well, let's take your experience, Candy, and apply it to today. So, you know, we're releasing this on Monday, and tomorrow is the Georgia runoff. And so for the Democrats to maintain control of the Senate, they need to win both those seats. If the Republicans win one or both, then it'll be Republican controlled. So what will the impact of that election be on the Senate process, the confirmation process, and also speed in your view, Candy?
I think the first challenge as I look at it in either case is the process by which to get the Senate confirmations done is going to be slow because we have to wait to see when the results will be determined in Georgia. You know, how many days will it take before we know the outcome? And then after that, you have to have the two leaders meet to set up the ratios and to determine, you know, who's on the committees. All of those processes have been put on hold, and normally they would be completed in December. And, you know, in the case for Phil, when he had the Obama nominees going through, you had a process that was set up. You could begin it early. You could begin discussions with the committees, you know, right after the election. And right now, the Biden team can't really begin the discussions. They can have preliminary, but you're still waiting to determine who's going to be the staff director of the committee, because who's going to be running the committees and who's going to be on the committees. And is the ratio 50-50, so it's evenly split, or is it going to be one plus one for Republicans? And so I think, unfortunately, it's going to slow the process initially, and it's going to take a week, maybe a week and a half to really get these committees up and running, which means that the ability to move the nominees pre-inauguration is going to be much more limited. There's a lot less time to do it because the structure isn't in place.
So let's just unpack that a little. Maybe Phil, you can add this for some of our listeners who may not be Senate experts like you. So typically we know who is going to control the Senate in December and they have organizing meetings. And then in the Constitution, the Congress is sworn in on January 3rd. And so they're typically there are 17 days between January 3rd and January 20th where they have pre-inaugural hearings. So, but now what you're saying is that process will be slowed. So how do you see this playing out, Phil, over the next 17 days?
It's very hard to know because layered on top of that is a coronavirus epidemic, which is impacting the ability of sometimes senators to actually be in Washington. So ideally, we'll know the results in Georgia fast, but if it's close races, as Candy was saying, that could take 4, 5, 6 days. And the Senate's in limbo during that period unless some arrangement could be worked out between the leadership. I think that would be unlikely. So I think the Senate would be in limbo. And then the hearings start to get scheduled. You know, time is running. So I would expect a slower process for any nominee that's not a consensus nominee.
Well, so just going back to your experience, Phil, you really set best practice by talking to the Senate pre-election in October of the year that Obama was running. And, you know, that some would say that looks presumptuous. The partnership would say that looks smart because we want people to look presumptuous and expect to win because you might win, which you did. And, you know, the data shows that 95% of cabinet secretaries have benefited from pre-inauguration hearings.
Yep.
And so why are those pre-inaugural hearings so important? And do you think President Biden's nominees will get that courtesy?
I think some of them will. I think for others, it could be slower. The reason it's so important, and Candy, I think, will probably have a clearer recollection of this, it's extraordinary what happens in the United States, because on Inauguration Day, incumbent president is still in control of the country up until the new president is sworn in. And I remember on Inauguration Day in 2009, there were going to be parades that afternoon, but some of us, a small group of us, about 15 to 20, had a report to work at the White House that afternoon. I was at my desk by around 2 o'clock, Inauguration Day, trying to learn the building and just the basics, but it's a handover of government. And if you think of it in a business term, there's no business in America that would have the existing management leave and then a gap before new management comes in. That's why the pre-inaugural hearings are so important, so that on Inauguration Day, as many of the cabinet members could be confirmed as possible. I think Candy's group between the vice president's office and President Bush's office did a terrific job, because I think they got a large number confirmed.
Seven. Same with Obama.
Yeah, I think we did something similar. But that's because those are the people who have to operate the government, who have to be there. And if there's a vacuum, that's terrible for the country. That can't happen unless there are hearings pre-inauguration.
Yeah. I mean, the data is fascinating. So Bush and Obama each got 7 day of the inauguration. Trump had 2. You know, a lot of his nominees had paperwork problems and they hadn't even completed their background checks when their paperwork was sent up. So it was, you know, slow. You know, even looking fast forward, again, Candy's team, they were very buttoned up. And at the end of the first year, Bush had more Senate-confirmed officials in place than any other president. But it was still only 521 out of 1,250, which means that the best president ever, the fastest ever, which was George W. Bush, even though he had a slow start, only had 40% of his administration in place at the one-year mark. So, you know, is something wrong with this system?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Something is definitely wrong with the system. Candy, do you mind if I jump in here?
No, go ahead and I'll chime in after you.
Look, it's silly to think that Washington, there was a time where it wasn't partisan. There's always partisanship, but some of the norms that used to be in place have slowly eroded over time. I remember feeling this in 2010. We were trying to meet with the Senate Republican leadership to say, look, we got a problem. Under George Bush, there were normally no more than 10 nominees on the Senate calendar. That means nominees that have been reported out of committee and waiting for a vote on the floor. And so most of the time, there were no more than 10. In our case, and I remember one meeting in particular, we had 80 nominees pending.
Wow.
We had at least 70 of those nominees who'd been on the calendar for more than two weeks. We had a situation that's still one that bothers me, because she was a friend of mine, Cassandra Butts, who is President Obama's nominee to be ambassador to the Bahamas. Now, this came a little bit later, but she was nominated in February of 2014. She had a hearing in May of 2014. This is with Democrats in control, but then holds were put on her consecutively by 2 senators. She waited over 800 days for a vote, and she died during that process. It was tragic. But one senator had put a hold on her because he objected to the Iran nuclear deal. Another senator was upset about something that he thought President Obama did, and knew that President Obama was friends with Cassandra, and said he put a hold on her to inflict pain on the president. That's what I meant earlier about the when nominees become pawns. We had a situation where we had a judge who we were trying to move, who waited 4 months for a vote, and then was confirmed 98-0. Mm-hmm. That's not one you would need on the floor. So the combination of the what you said before, Dave, about the number of nominees that have to be confirmed, just the grueling process nominees have to go through to make sure there are no issues. And then when these ancillary issues come up and the process just bogs down, and that's where there's the intersection between trying to slow down the process for nominees, because that means then that there's less time to do time on the Senate floor for legislation. You talked before about traffic. And one of the analogies I used to use with our Leg Affairs team throughout my time is I analogized us to air traffic controllers. We were continually trying to land planes on the Senate floor without any crashes. And it's hard when there's a backup in the air, but that's what the job is. Sorry, Candy.
No, I wanted to echo, I think, your whole point around how much the nominees have become pawns and how the process has evolved to the point where members on both sides of the aisle feel like they can just hold up the nominees for unrelated reasons, not because of the qualification and their ability to do the job, but because they want something. And I always found, Phil, and you may have found the same, that the challenge often was with your own party.
Right.
I thought it was harder to get a lot of the nominees through from the Republicans. It was easier to sort of figure out from Democrats what might be needed to try to move and you know, resolve some of the concerns. But the Republicans would hold up for, you know, completely unrelated issues, which I won't call some of them out because they're still in Congress.
Right.
you know, it took months. And you have to have the attention and the team and the people who can just spend the time to try to work off the holds and work off the problems and figure out if you can come up with a solution. And it's incredibly frustrating and very frustrating for the nominees who really don't understand why this process takes as long as it takes. And they just want to get in there and do their job.
Yeah, the data fascinates me. And we did some analysis of the Obama nominations in the first 2 years. I think it was the 111th Congress. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But in the Finance Committee, which you mentioned, Phil, Obama had 50% of his nominees get through the Finance Committee, only 50% when there were either 59 or 60 Democrats in the Senate.
Right.
Which is kind of an abysmal record for that committee. And they eventually got through, but it just shows you how slow it is. And let's fast forward and apply this to today. So we're now in a pandemic. We have a deep economic crisis. We have, you know, Biden is facing basically the third worst set of problems any new president has ever faced after Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt. So, and if you look at the data, so in the Bush administration in the Department of Health and Human Services, Bush got his second nominee in at HHS on May 1st, more than 100 days after he was sworn in. And under Obama, you know, Senator Tom Daschle was nominated. He had some problems. I know, Phil, you worked for him. I'm a longtime admirer and, you know, friend of his and his son. You know, so that was a tragic incident from my perspective. But Kathleen Sebelius didn't get sworn in at HHS until April 28th. So can you imagine it moving that slowly during a pandemic at HHS or at Treasury with the economic problems we're having?
The one thing I have noticed in the data, and when you look at many of the nominees, it tends to be the crises that will ultimately drive the action. You know, if we had somebody who was pending for a long period of time and something happened in that department, it would drive action. So I guess I'm a glass half full here and see the pandemic as a driver that will focus attention on HHS. And certainly the messaging, the arguments that the Biden team can bring to the table to make the point that it's going to be critical to get the vaccines approved, to get the distribution done, to deal with the health crises, you have to have someone at HHS. I think, Dave, in this case, it should result in a faster confirmation process than the ones that you alluded to. At those times, while health is a big priority, there probably wasn't a crisis in front of us that sort of drove action at the time, which is unfortunate that it takes that kind of crisis to ultimately get Congress to have to act, but that tends to be the case.
Right, because we've identified around 50 critical pandemic-related positions which require Senate confirmation, not just the Secretary of Health, but the FDA Commissioner, the head of Medicare and Medicaid services. There's an assistant secretary responsible for emergency planning. And then at the Department of Agriculture, there's a health-related official that's responsible for rural health. And, you know, we want to get the vaccine out to rural communities as quickly as possible. At Homeland Security, there's pandemic-related folks at USAID. And so hopefully they'll break the norm and move quickly. Phil, I wanted to pick up on something that Candy mentioned, which is the Sherpas. So the Biden team is not calling them Sherpas, they're calling them navigators. And they're basically people that help the nominees navigate the process. So you and Mark Patterson recruited a bunch of Sherpas for the Obama nominees. And what did those Sherpas do? And what advice would you have for the Biden navigators who are helping the Biden nominees through the system right now?
It's staying on schedule, and it's doing constant outreach, making sure the navigators, Sherpas' job is to make sure there are no potholes that are being hit. So that means not neglecting a key meeting with a senator. It means that making sure the nominee has disclosed everything that needs to be disclosed, getting ready for the confirmation hearing and being able to answer all the questions that might come up. It's really just thinking through someone whose sole focus is helping that nominee through the process. And the same that happens with Supreme Court nominees. But the one thing that is precious and folks can't get it back is each day, is each week. So my advice would be making sure that each day is being used the best way it can. And I think Candy probably had the same experience, which is in a normal world, most of the nominees don't end up being that time consuming. The ones that are time consuming, the ones who have problems, the ones where an issue arises, maybe it's a tax issue or something else. And that ends up taking up 90% of the time. That would be in normal times. We'll have to see as we get to January 20th, whether there'll just be a general approach of slowing everything down. And again, if that happens, the navigator's role is to do their best to keep it on schedule to get the person confirmed.
And Candy, what advice would you have for the Biden navigators?
Now, I concur with what Phil has kind of laid out, that, you know, keeping on track and getting as much ready. They can't control the outcome of the Georgia election. They don't know the timing of when the Senate will be set up, but you can go in and you know you're gonna need to have conversations with the committee members and those that are currently at least on the committee, with the committee staff that's already there. So making sure all of the pieces are in place and that when the process is a go and you can begin to really push to get the committees to have pre-inauguration hearings, then you're ready and your nominee is briefed. They've had their mock hearing. They've done all of the work that they need to do so that you don't have any additional challenges when you have the runway. As Phil said, you got to land the plane and you've got a lot of, different actions going on. So to have everything just as lined up as you can possibly have it lined up.
And how do they deal with contingencies, with competing priorities? So let's say you have a navigator that's responsible for the Health and Human Services Secretary or someone in that department. And then you have another navigator that's responsible for the Treasury Department. And they both have to go through the Finance Committee. And Phil, you mentioned prioritization. So the White House has priorities, the Senate has priorities. How do the navigators deal with competing priorities?
Phil, I'd assume in this case that that kind of the folks that are managing it within the transition team
right.
would have to really make the determination.
Yep.
But I'd certainly argue for both and tell them that they're quite capable and both are necessary. Right. One for the financial health of the country and the other for the, you know, the health of the country. And so, you know, you'd encourage them to do both. And to move them one after the other. But I would assume that someone else is going to have to call the shots and make the determination as to who ultimately gets priority if it comes to that.
I think that's right. And this doesn't apply so much to the first wave, but when you're talking about the navigators, Dave, one of their jobs is to try to keep the nominees from making unforced errors. And Candy referenced before how hard the process is sometimes for the nominees. Sometimes the nominees can't help themselves on the prioritization question and start going a little bit rogue, mm-hmm. so they can move up the ladder. That doesn't work out very well. So if I'm not talking about present circumstances, I'm looking back in the past, from a navigator standpoint, is making sure that doesn't happen.
And the person that has to probably resolve these disputes is the person that's taking your old job, Candy and Phil, which is Louisa Terrell, who, you know, is a really extraordinary person. And Phil, you're one of her mentors, and she worked for you. And so tell our listeners about Louisa, what type of person she is, and what type of priorities and what her life is like today.
I get tired just thinking about what her life is like today. Because there's more things to do every day than there's time to do it, and more demands and more incoming. She has to juggle all those things. She's tremendous. She's very smart. She knows the House and Senate inside and out. She has something that's very important, which is a strong personal relationship with the president-elect. And she's great at something. She's great at a lot of things. But Candy, when she had the job, was great at a lot of things too. But one of the things that people always talked about with Candy was her communication focus and how she stayed in touch with everybody on both sides. And that's also a particular strength for Louisa. So I'm sure she's doing that now. She's putting together a team that she's using now for the transition, but that may not be the same team she has in the White House. So she's putting together teams simultaneously, trying to sequence the nominees, trying to work with the president-elect on his legislative agenda and what those priorities are going to be. It really is an overwhelming task.
And you both dealt with Congress as being controlled by the opposite party, so which Biden may face. So how did your legislative strategy and also your confirmation strategy change when the Senate was controlled by the opposite party?
I think for us, you know, this was the last couple of years of the Bush administration. And so much of the focus around legislation at that point was trying to ensure you had enough votes to sustain a veto. It was really interesting because so much of Leg Affairs and the job that's involved is to be able to count the votes and know whether legislation can get enacted. Similarly, of course, that there are sufficient votes for your nominees if you have nominees that have any particular challenges. But I think when you have a minority, when you're working with the opposition, in the case for Bush, it was both the House and the Senate. So it was really going to be the president most likely vetoing legislation he didn't like and being able to sustain it. So it was just a different approach. But I found, as Phil said, you know, that the number one issue in my mind was always to have communication. You could agree to disagree with the other party around policy outcomes, but I never wanted somebody to be surprised. And you always wanted to try to have a line of communication so you could understand, is there a place where we could find some common ground? Are there some areas where perhaps there could be agreement that can be reached? And, you know, no surprises, because in the business we all had, your word is your bond. And that's really all you have to go on. You have to have trust. You have to build up that trust, and you build it by being straight and communicating, and keeping, you know, people informed. And, you know, so much is the relationships that you have and how people interact with you. And around that, I think it's critically important, you know, to deal with the little things, right? What is it that members really needed? Well, maybe when they eventually have tours again, you want to tour the White House for your constituents. You want to get a signed letter congratulating somebody on, you know, the birth of a child or an anniversary. Those things were really important. And those little issues were what the team focused on to make sure that we had a communication that crossed, you know, both sides of the aisle. So maybe we disagree on policy, but to make sure that there are things that a White House had and provided that could make it easier for a member with their constituents in terms of getting some things done. So communication.
Got it. All right. So I have a couple more questions, but I want to do a little trivia with you. So we have this little transition trivia project we're doing with Politico. There's a Politico newsletter that comes out every day on the transition, and we kind of feed them. Maybe it's nerdy. I kind of love it, but it's a transition trivia. So let's test your knowledge, okay? So which modern president, so let's call that since Carter, had the most nominees confirmed on Inauguration Day, and which had the fewest? Who wants to take either one of those?
I think it was Bush, 43.
Bush, 43 had the most?
Most.
Okay, Phil, your view?
I would guess Clinton for the most and Trump for the least.
Yeah, Trump for the least.
Okay, so Jimmy Carter had 8 confirmed on Inauguration Day, 1977. George H.W. Bush had 0. So 0 members of his new cabinet were confirmed. First was confirmed on January 25th, 1989. So obviously it was a Republican transition.
Right.
So
that's different.
Okay. How about this one? Which modern president had 14 of his 15 statutory cabinet secretaries in place by January 21st? So there are 15 cabinet agencies which are in the statute, and then a president can, you know, have other nominees or other officials be in the cabinet. So who had 14 out of 15 in within 2 days by January 21st?
I think Clinton did, didn't he?
I think he was pretty close to that.
Clinton.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a rocky transition, but he had a great cabinet and did a very good job confirming. Okay, how about this? How many of the president's initial cabinet members have been withdrawn before Senate consideration? So the first cabinet that they name since Clinton, how many have been withdrawn?
So total, like you're adding up all of the presidents mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. each president individually?
All of them. Well, maybe you can remember your own presidents. So
we had one, Labor.
Right, Linda Chavez, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we had 2, but maybe 3, depending on how you count. Because we had Bill Richardson and Tom Daschle, but then we had Judd Gregg. So I don't know if you count him or not.
So we would count that as 2 because it was the initial nominees. And I think Trump had 1.
And Clinton had 1. Right?
Clinton had 1, the Attorney General, Zoe Baird, and then...
So that's 5? Are we at 5?
Is our math 5. Right? Yeah, so it's very few, actually. The interesting thing is looking at the data and looking at the history, the press focuses on all the failures. And so, you know, Phil, during your time... You know, it was all about Daschle that dominated the news. But what people in the press didn't focus on was virtually most of the cabinet got through quickly. You know, Geithner got in 5 or 6 days late, but the record's pretty good. 95% of the initial nominees get pre-inaugural hearings and 85% get in within a couple of days. So, all right, let me close with this. Looking back at your White House experience, I love to ask our guests this question. What's the thing that makes you most proud of your time in the White House? So Candy, why don't we start with you?
I mean, the whole job was just an honor and a privilege. And it was waking up every day and being in the White House and understanding what a privilege it was to work there and to provide public service and to be supporting the American people. I mean, I remember Andy Card saying, and he was the chief of staff for Bush 43 for the first term. And I remember Andy saying, you know, the hardest thing about the job you have at the White House is knowing when to leave. And when it no longer becomes an honor and a privilege and you don't recognize sort of what you're supporting, then you know that it's time to go. And I think that was really good advice that, you know, you serve the country. You serve at the pleasure of the president. And to me, it was just being part of that process and seeing legislation get through. I think in the piece that I'm really most pleased with, was one of sort of the last trade agreements that got through. It's not the last, but it was pretty tough. It was the CAFTA trade agreement. And I remember that passing with one vote in the House and just feeling really good about knowing where the vote count was going to be and not losing one.
Yeah, I think there were like 14 or 15.
I left before TARP. So I'm just for the record, that wasn't lost on my watch.
I mean, you probably have the record for the legislation that caused the biggest drop in the Dow in the United States in history during your time. So, but Candy kind of threw you under the bus on that one, not me.
Yeah.
But so Phil, what about you? What moment was the proudest moment when you were in the White House?
Well, it's hard to add to Candy's answer on the feeling of being in the White House. I say for, if I'm personalizing it to myself, I think it's a combination of things. Always trying to give the president a realistic, accurate assessment as we were developing strategies of what would work, what wouldn't work. Having a team at Legislative Affairs that was just terrific. Individually, collectively, their professionalism, the people they were, because those are the people I spent the most time with on day in, day out, and they were just great. And if I had to pick a piece of legislation, it was the Affordable Care Act, because it meant so much to the president, and it was so difficult to do. We had to navigate so many problems, but if I had to say one piece of legislation, it would probably be that.
Well, Candy Wolf, Phil Schillero, thank you for spending this time with us. Thanks for sharing your wisdom. And most importantly, thank you for service to our country.
Thanks, Dave. This was a pleasure.
Thank you.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.